Bastille volunteer forces have held a massive parade in support of the people of Palestine. The parades were conducted along the shores of the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and the Caspian Sea on the occasion of the International Quds Day. The parade is a show of condemnation of Israel's crimes in Gaza. In addition to Iran's flag, the vessels are carrying the flag of Palestine as a sign of solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza. Massive rallies will be held across world countries on Friday in support of Palestinians and their decades-long resistance against the Israeli occupation regime. Senior IRGC Navy Commander Mehdi Ekhtiari says the naval parade in northern and southern territorial waters of Iran is not only in support of Palestine, but also a message of peace to neighboring countries.
This parade is being held for the fourth year and is being held on the occasion of International Quds Day with the participation of civilian vessels. This is actually a message, first to all of the Islamic world, that all people from land to sea are supporting the Palestinians and the Holy Al-Quds. Second, to the people of the Caspian Sea coastal countries, that the sea is the sea of peace and friendship. The parade shows that Iran is ready to always stand by people, neighboring countries, and also protect the Islamic Republic and country's sovereignty against threats. The point I have to tell you is that this parade is being held simultaneously on the coast of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, on the coasts of Jask and Chabahar, with the participation of more than 3,000 ships.
We bring you an exclusive interview with senior Iranian Navy Commander Mohammad Bagheri, who emphasized that today's naval drills stand in solidarity with Palestinians and to condemn Israeli genocide in Gaza.
The event you are witnessing today is the naval parade conducted by the Iranian Navy Forces and Basij Volunteer Forces. A total of 150 vessels of Basij bases and 30 vessels from the IRGC Navy's northern base are participating in the parade in Babolsa. This parade is held in solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine and to condemn the crimes committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza. The purpose of this exercise is also to show the military strength of Iran's Basij Volunteer Forces and to enhance unity among Basij forces, armed forces, and people of Iran. Basij volunteer forces, like the armed forces, are always working tirelessly to defend our maritime and territorial borders.
Iranians are getting ready to celebrate International Quds Day. Our correspondent Gisumish Ahmadi has spoken with a number of Iranian people to get their views on this year's Quds Day. Here's what they had to say.
Participating in the rallies is both a religious and a human duty. Just like all Muslims around the world, we will join in solidarity with the Palestinians to show our support.
I hope that one day, very soon, we can hold mass prayers together with Palestinians and they will achieve victory.
I will definitely participate in the rallies. It is my duty to support this cause.
This day is essential for us. And the issue that concerns Muslims worldwide is Gaza. Therefore, I not only pray for them, but also actively participate in the rallies.
The Palestinians are part of us, and we will always stand by their side.
The Palestinians fighting against oppression should know that they have our unwavering support.
Palestinian and other resistance leaders and officials have addressed the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza and other regional developments in messages issued on the occasion of the upcoming International Quds Day. They have also highlighted the significance of this event, which is marked on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, a day dedicated to showing solidarity with the Palestinian people worldwide. Let's take a listen to what they had to say.
At the end of my speech, I underscore the following. First, the unity of the forces of resistance in the region will continue, whatever be the sacrifices. Number two, the Palestinian people will continue to stand resilient on their territory, holding on to their territory, and will not accept any other alternative other than this territory. Number three, the Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine will continue to live up to the pledge, to its pledge, to the martyrs and its principles, and to the martyrs from amongst the Palestinian people, and it will continue to commit to the unity of the forces of resistance against the aggression. Number four, the forces of resistance will continue to commit to their firm stance of liberating all of our captives in exchange for the captives of the enemy. and in addition to that, the withdrawal of the enemy's forces from all the territories which they entered into the Gaza Strip. The aggressive course of the Israelis with the American partnership, this is in order to achieve a clear goal, striving to eliminate the Palestinian cause and an attempt to displace the Palestinian people from Palestine. And this is clear in the statements and the declared stances and statements from the Americans and the Israelis. I underscore that we remain committed firmly to our stance based on principle and based on ethics and values in support of the Palestinian people in whatever way we can. The resistance took the initiative with the storm to re-establish the equations of the conflict, which will not go backwards. The clock will not turn backwards, and the resistance has proven its ability to take the initiative and to go on the offense, thank God. It showed the world the incapability and the security military failure of the Israeli enemy and its inability to break the will of our people and their resistance, despite 15 months of fighting or killing and terrorism and destruction, despite the complete full-fledged support from the United States of America for the enemy and the open-ended political cover which is provided in order to commit war crimes and genocide and starvation and the assassinations.
More Palestinian civilians fall victim to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza as the regime continues to pound the blockaded territory with air and artillery strikes. In one of its latest attacks on Gaza City, Israeli aircraft bombed a home in the Asaftavi area, killing 7 Palestinians. In central Gaza, artillery shelling targeted the northern neighborhoods of the Boraj, Nuseirat, and Al-Maghazi refugee camps. Regime forces also destroyed residential homes in Beit Lahia. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 25 people were killed since the early hours of this morning. This includes Hamas spokesperson Abdel Latif Al-Khanoua, who was martyred after his tent was bombed in Jabalia al-Balad, north of Gaza. The attacks come as the death toll from Israel's renewed aggression since last Tuesday has reached 855. The overall toll from the genocide in Gaza has surpassed 50,200, with more than 113,900 others wounded. Since the start of the Gaza genocide, the Israeli regime has targeted journalists in an attempt to suppress coverage of its atrocities in the territory. In its latest assault on northern Gaza, 2 Palestinian journalists were killed, bringing the total number of media workers killed since October 2023 to 208. In response, Palestinian journalists gathered outside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus, south of Gaza, to protest the attacks on their colleagues. Here's what one of them had to say.
In an attempt to suppress footage and silence journalists, many attacks were directed at our families. We were displaced and threatened repeatedly, all to prevent us from delivering the truth to the world and to ensure that only the occupation's narrative prevailed. All these targeted attacks and actions carried out by the occupation forces to suppress the image and truth will not deter us from continuing on our path. We will keep sending our message to the world, exposing the crimes of the occupation, and laying them bare before the conscience of all humanity. We call on the international community to uphold its responsibility towards Palestinian journalists and impose the maximum penalties on these criminals who target us and our families day and night.
Tensions are running high across the occupied West Bank as the Israeli military presses ahead with incursions into its towns and refugee camps. A Palestinian teenager has been killed and several others injured in the latest attacks. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Naka Hamid in Ramallah for more details.
In the last 12 hours, the Palestinian Ministry of Health has declared the martyrdom of the Palestinian young man Ismail Samir Ashurafa, 18 years old, from Beita, who was shot by Israeli forces near the town of Huwara. The IOF, while raiding Beita, has it has assaulted Palestinians. Among them, many Palestinian journalists were assaulted in the entrance of Beita. Not only in Nablus, but also the situation was extremely tense in Jenin and in Tul Kerem, as the IOF is getting ready to demolish even more homes to the already demolished infrastructure and buildings inside Jenin refugee camp and Nur Shams refugee camp. Moving a little bit over here towards Ramallah, where clashes happened between Palestinians and young Palestinians and IOF forces inside Silwad village, also Al-Mughayyar village, Turmus Aya. Many areas that have been raided through the hours of the night by the IOF forces. Going towards Al-Khalil, where a major attack on the Palestinian village of Beit Umar to the north of Al-Khalil took place while Palestinians were praying.
At least four people have been killed in an Israeli drone attack on south of Lebanon in a new violation of a ceasefire agreement with the Arab country. Regime's aircraft targeted a vehicle in the town of Yomor Ashakif. The Israeli army has also shelled areas in south of Lebanon. Tel Aviv claims that the target of its attack were Hezbollah fighters. The Israeli military frequently conducts airstrikes in Lebanon despite a ceasefire agreement that was signed in November last year. The regime has defied calls to adhere to its obligations under the agreement, including the withdrawal of its forces from south of Lebanon. Israeli airstrikes have targeted multiple locations in Syria's western Latakia governorate in a new wave of aggression. Footage from one of the attacks shows thick plumes of smoke rising from facilities at the White Port following the attack. In a separate strike, Israeli warplanes also targeted the Syrian Army's 110th Naval Brigade in the same province. There have been no confirmed reports of casualties so far. This follows a deadly wave of airstrikes in southern Daraa governorate less than a week ago, which killed at least seven people, including a woman. Such strikes have become more frequent across Syria since the ousting of the country's former government in December, which led to the capture of control by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham militants. Yemen's military has executed another precision attack, striking both American and Israeli positions. The operation once again brought Israel's major airport to a halt. Our correspondent in Sana'a has filed this report.
Yemeni forces have once again carried out retaliatory strikes against Israeli assets, forcing the regime to shut down Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. The latest move marks the fifth day in a row of strategic responses to Israel's ongoing bloodshed against the Palestinians. The Yemeni armed forces also emphasized their continued commitment to escalate in response to the aggression against Gaza and Yemen.
We will persist in confronting American aggression and will meet escalation with escalation. We will continue to block Israeli maritime activity in the declared operational zone and will carry out strikes against the Israeli enemy until the attacks end and the siege on Gaza is lifted.
U.S. President Donald Trump has issued a number of threats directed at Ansar al-Law, warning that if Yemenis don't end their naval blockade on Israel, hell will rain down upon them. These threats have only emboldened the resistance movement to step up attacks.
We don't care about these American threats. Trump knows he'll never defeat Ansarullah. Our message to him is, threaten us all you want. We will never betray the Palestinian people. No matter what happens, the Yemeni armed forces will be victorious, and the U.S., as we are seeing, will always fail.
Trump also claims that the U.S. attacks have killed a number of Ansar al-Law leaders.
Trump says he is targeting Ansarullah's leadership in government, but he's actually attacking Yemeni civilians, and this has been proven with video. The Yemeni army is targeting the U.S. aircraft carrier because they are striking civilian neighborhoods. Trump has failed across the board to achieve anything, just as the Saudi coalition aggressors before him also failed.
Yemen's armed forces have vowed that as long as the bombs fall on Gaza and the aggression against Yemen continues, their missiles will not stop flying and their resistance will only grow stronger. The Yemeni armed forces are threatening to step up their attacks against all U.S. and Israeli military sites across the region. If the attacks continue on Yemen and on Gaza, Ansar al-Law says it will launch new military operations in the near future. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
U.S. President Donald Trump has announced steep new tariffs on imported automobiles and parts, with additional trade levies expected next week.
And what we're going to be doing is a 25% tariff on all cars that are not made in the United States. If they're made in the United States, there's absolutely no tariff. We start off with a 2.5% base, which is what we were at, and we go to 25%.
The duties set to take effect April the 3rd will target foreign-made cars, light trucks, and key auto components. The sudden move sent shockwaves through global markets, with Wall Street slumping and the world's top-selling automaker, Toyota, plunging over 3%. The decision has also drawn sharp backlash from the U.S. trading partners. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney branded the tariffs as a direct attack on Canadian workers and announced an emergency cabinet meeting to weigh retaliatory measures. Brazil and Japan also voiced similar concerns, warning of the potential harm to the global economy.
The same people who defend free trade practice protectionism. These tariffs are very bad because instead of facilitating trade in the world, it is hindering it. We'll see the consequences. I think it will be bad for the United States. If Donald Trump is thinking of taxing everything that his country imports, I think that's going to be very damaging to the United States. It's going to raise the price of things and it could lead to a kind of inflation that he doesn't even grasp.
In response to this announcement, which we consider to be extremely regrettable, we have again strongly urged the U.S. government to exclude Japan from the scope of these measures. We believe that the broad scope of trade restrictions imposed by the United States government could have a significant impact on the U.S.-Japan trade relationship, as well as the global economy and multilateral trade system as a whole.
And that is a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you so much for staying with us.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kaba Takwai. Our guest today is Graham Fuller. He is an American author and political analyst, and he specialized in terrorism and extremism, especially in the West Asia region. Now, formerly, he was the vice chair of the National Intelligence Council, and he also served as a station chief in Kabul for the CIA. And he now joins us for this edition of the program. Graham Fuller, welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you, Kaba. My pleasure.
Yes, our pleasure also. Let's start out with the fact that you specialize in terrorism based on the bio that we have read on you, specifically in West Asia or Middle East, as some call it. And you were also the vice chair of the National Intelligence Council, and you served as the station chief in Kabul for the CIA. Now, given that background, especially the last part, I'd like to find out from you how the CIA portion of your background, given the fact that it has been involved in regime change operations, how it incorporated itself, in order for us to get an idea, if that is something that you're even allowed to speak on.
Well, it's not so much whether I'm allowed to speak about it. I never was involved in that kind of thing personally. I was in the Middle East. I should correct you. I was not a terrorist specialism. I was an analyst and reporting on political developments and political analysis. I had very little to do with terrorism except observing it as a political phenomenon in the region. So I think there is a great deal written about CIA involvement in regime change over the years. But fortunately, did not have to become involved in that, and I'm glad because I would have probably had a lot of personal problems with becoming involved in it. But yes, major powers have been involved, including the British going back hundreds of years, the U.S. involved in changing regimes that they don't like. It goes on in Europe, elsewhere, so this is nothing new.
Maybe you can tell us then, during the time that you were the station chief in Kabul, it was during that time, based on, again, history, the Soviet Union at that time sent thousands of troops into Afghanistan, and they assumed complete military and political control of Kabul. At that point, then U.S. President Jimmy Carter was authorized for collaboration between the CIA and Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, the ISI. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up is because at that point, the U.S. actually was providing funds for the Mujahideen, as it was cited. This is the part that I want to ask you about, is why the U.S. would be involved in doing that, lining itself up either directly or indirectly by this financial support that it gave to the Mujahideen then.
Well, I should think it's obvious. First of all, I should say personally, I served 3 years, and my three-year tour in Afghanistan ended roughly about the time of the Sour Revolution, when the communist pro-Russian communist movement Parcham pulled a coup d'état and replaced the former ruler. At that point, within the new government was very incompetent. They did not know how to run the country. Rebellions were springing up here, there, and elsewhere from traditional religious sources. And they finally had to invite the Soviet Union to come in and protect the new regime, which the Soviet Union did. In any case, I had left Afghanistan at that point. But I was interested and well aware of these events. I'm surprised that you are surprised that Washington was involved. This was a direct invasion by the Soviet Union into Afghanistan to preserve a communist regime that upset every Muslim regime in the area. Certainly Pakistan, certainly Saudi Arabia, most of the Arab states were strongly disapproved of the Soviet invasion to defend a communist regime, a new communist regime in Afghanistan. So there's nothing surprising to me at all that this is what the Russians did. And it, of course, was spectacularly unsuccessful, just as so many American interventions militarily have been ultimately unsuccessful.
Yeah, it wasn't the fact that I was surprised. The point that I was zooming in on, which is a lead up to the question that I want to ask you now, is the way that the U.S. actually supports groups that it opposes. And my question is going to be now merged with this notion of how, for example, you have talked about the ISIL, which we call Daesh terrorists. What are your thoughts, and what have you said about, maybe I should ask you, about ISIL? Because I have what you have said in an interview. I think the U.S. is one of the key creators of ISIL. Again, we call them Daesh. The U.S. did not plan the formation, but its destructive interventions in the Middle East, West Asia, and the war in Iraq were the basic causes of the birth of ISIS.
Well, at that point, I think the U.S. was still continuously very much focused on anti-Russian policies, and that actually is even true, has been true up to very recently. So at that point, the Washington seemed to be willing to play with the devil and lend some initial support to ISIS or ISIL. ISIS is how it's better known in the West, to essentially weaken any effort by left-wing or pro-Soviet forces in the region.
Very well. I'll skew my questions in other ways then. We won't be talking about that CIA regime change stuff. So let's, I'm going to start.
I disapprove of CIA regime change. I've all my life. but I have not been involved in it.
No. I didn't mean to imply that you were involved in it. I was just wondering the inner workings of how that comes about, because it's obviously something that we are have been a victim of.
The way I know about these mechanisms is reading about it and hearing about it indirectly. We all know the U.S. has supported so-called democratic groups within these countries through the National Democracy Institute in Washington, maybe AID at some point, supporting alternative parties, supporting groups that are unhappy with the existing government and are seeking to overthrow them. There have been a variety of techniques that CIA has been involved in, almost all of them unsuccessful, and fortunate. Anyway, enough said on that.
Sure. Well, since we're talking about the region that we're in, which is where I'd like to continue with you, I'd like to talk about Iraq because the anniversary is coming up, the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. The way that worked out obviously opened a Pandora's box. Tell us, and I'm quoting you here, we must remember that there would be no ISIS today if the U.S. had not invaded and destroyed Iraq's leadership, government, etc. These terrorists are a product of that in terms of what we have seen, again, whether it's ISIS, ISIL, we call them Daesh. Tell us what happened there, why that became one of the consequences.
Well, Saddam Hussein, who was a horrific leader, as we all know, in Iraq, and a butcher, essentially viewed any Islamic opposition, or any opposition for that matter, but especially Islamic opposition, as extremely dangerous. And so he moved ruthlessly to destroy any of these movements that existed. So the United States, I think, rather opportunistically sought to support certain anti-Iraqi regime Islamic forces in the name of defeating Saddam Hussein. And also when Saddam collapsed, the country was absolutely without law and order. The U.S. was not able to maintain law and order, and these jihadi groups took advantage of that opportunity to build their power and to establish themselves in parts of eastern Iraq.
Well, when you talk about the way that the U.S. was involved, either directly, indirectly, or covertly, it is not the first time that has happened. I want to cite an example that proves this, which was an AP investigation, and it's regarding the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, where one of the findings of the investigation was that there was a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., and that it actually won decisive victories that drove Al-Qaeda from their strongholds across Yemen, and the coalition actually cut secret deals with Al-Qaeda in the form of financing or in the form of arms. And that's what happened, paying some to leave key cities and towns. Does the U.S. use that as a method to line itself up, again, in one way or another with the terrorists in order to achieve its aims and goals?
Basically, I think in terms of Saudi Arabia, Washington has tried to work on the side of Saudi Arabia, with Saudi Arabia, against Islamist terrorist groups, and the Saudi government would fully agree with that. But I don't have any information, was not directly involved in any of that kind of activity. But yes, the U.S. has been very opportunistic in supporting, there is an expression in English saying, any stick to beat a dog, and so, which means you grab a hold of anything that is useful, a useful tool to beat down your enemy. So, but basically, the United States has been more focused on the war against terrorism than it has been on supporting terrorist groups.
Okay. Well, we still know that the U.S. is involved in one form or another. There was plenty of evidence that came out during the war on Syria that transpired over the 11 or 12 years. There was even reports of how there were these terrorists that were a stone's throw away from the U.S. Base by the name of Al-Tanf. And that was even cited by Russia, of course. But these terrorists were in the area. The U.S. did exterminate some of them, but then we have seen what has happened to Syria. But let's move on more about the violation of Iraq's sovereignty. That war was a devastating one. To this day, we have reports that the U.S. holds Iraq hostage with the dollar. Basically, the revenues go into one account of the U.S. Treasury. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that really is a violation of a country's sovereignty. So is that the way that Iraq is being conducted in terms of its violation of its sovereignty by the U.S.?
Certainly, Iraq has never recovered fully its sovereignty after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the installation of a pro-American government there. There have been tensions, as I'm sure you know, between even the new anti-Saddam government and Washington. And I don't know any of the details, but I gather that there are some possible U.S. Involvement in oil sources from parts of Iraq. I just don't know anything about that. I have not followed Iraq for a long time and have not been in the area since then. I was in Afghanistan or in Hong Kong. But yes, I think clearly Iraq has not yet fully recovered its sovereignty, and that is a source of considerable anger to the Iraqi population, especially after the destruction of that country during the American attack and invasion.
The U.S. presence in West Asia is something that Iran has obviously been completely against for a variety of reasons, all of which is understandable based on its point of view. I'd like to find out from you what your thoughts are about what we are hearing these days, which is becoming louder and louder, and that's how the U.S. and the Israeli regime are beating the drums of war again. You know, they're talking about attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. They're using the nuclear bomb card again. And, you know, when we look back at how George Bush Jr. had ordered the Pentagon back in 2010 to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, he said that he had directed the Pentagon. This would stop the bomb clock at least temporarily. But, you know, here we are. It's 2025. I mean, we're looking at so many years to have gone by. Don't you think that this card of Iran being after the nuclear bomb is overplayed and really expired?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has been a basic part of U.S. policy in the Middle East, not only in the Middle East, in the world, I would say, to identify enemies and attempt to recruit neighboring countries into alliances with the U.S. That has been the case certainly now in the Persian Gulf, where the boogeyman of Iran in general and Iran's potential nuclear threat has been used to try to drive and bring other Gulf states into close cooperation, military cooperation even, with Washington. Frankly, I don't think this is going to happen. I think it's rather interesting and clear that Trump himself is not a fan of pushing towards ever greater war. And I think everyone knows that it's increasingly clear, especially under Biden, that Benjamin Netanyahu is working to try to drag Washington into a war supporting Israel against both in an attack against the Iranians' nuclear facilities and in a more general war. I think even Biden, who felt that that could be potentially dangerous, but essentially had no control over what Israel did. I think Trump, interestingly, maybe surprisingly, has no desire to go to war, in my understanding, with Iran, and on the contrary, is trying to reopen discussions with Iran on nuclear issues as well as other issues. I don't know how that will go. And typically, as we see, Trump always loves to threaten and bully at the same time while offering more positive incentives to the countries involved. So he's both suggested to Iran that he would like to have negotiations and then saying, and by God, you will pay a big price if you don't negotiate and don't cooperate on this and if you continue with the bomb. He's playing both sides against the middle. But my strong feeling is that he does not want to work with Bibi to go into a new war on that and would not like to have an American war that involves the United States. Also, very strikingly, I was quite surprised just the other day, a U.S. spokesman, I think it was Witkoff, publicly said that the United States is not Israel's puppet.
Okay, well, that's since you're mentioning Israel, we are looking at two attacks that took place in terms of counter attacks from Iran, Operation True Promise 1 and 2. Israel also has attacked Iran. This has been the closest the two have come to an all-out war. And the problem that we have over here is that Israel is nuclear armed, though it's undeclared. Something needs to be done about denuclearization. And that's something that Iran has voiced its concern. Qatar just came out days ago also voicing its concern. What can be done in order for the disaster not to happen and for Israel to comply in terms of becoming, a member of the NPT and to completely disarm from nuclear weapons?
Well, I'm afraid I think that's something of a wishful dream at this point. The problem is, as you well know, and as the world knows, that Israel is basically absolutely determined to maintain this nuclear superiority. On top of that, it has great support, domination in the Middle East and policy over American Congress and seemingly even in Europe to some extent. So I do not think that anybody is going to bring Israel for the foreseeable future, and I'm thinking 5-10 years at the very least. I don't see what it would be that would force Israel to give up its nuclear weapons, however desirable that might be. Congress would never support that, and I don't know what American president would support that either, and I'm not even sure most of European states, who are very weak, there's hardly any serious leadership in Europe right now, I don't think any of them would support it. The only long-term hope I have for a change in the relationship and role of Israel in the region is that Israel has grossly and outrageously overreached itself in its brutal and genocidal attacks against the Palestinian population and has won the disgust and anger of virtually the entire world, except in the U.S. and except in Western Europe. But I think as the global South, as you might call it, or BRICS states, or the non-Western states grow more and more disgusted with this and trying to put more and more pressure on Israel on questions of genocide and the ICJ, International Court of Justice, and other things, Israel is now very, very isolated. It doesn't affect its brutal policies in Gaza right now, but I believe that Israel is becoming more and more a pariah state, which will find over time it is not going to exercise the same voice or authority or influence as it does right now. Indeed, there are many Jews and many within Israel who are deeply concerned about the gradual moral collapse of the Israeli state.
Well, you know, we need to talk about this a little bit more in terms of what Israel has in mind for the West Asia region or Middle East, as the West calls it, because I can't help but look back at what, I'm sure you're aware of this, what the former American General Wesley Clark has said about how 7 countries are going to be toppled in West Asia. This is going back quite some time. The U.S. also believes in partitioning countries. We know that, for example, Condoleezza Rice talked about the new Middle East map, if you recall that, and also how Israel itself has this notion of greater Israel. You know, these all points to taking over countries or cutting countries apart. And this makes it dangerous. We've seen what happened in the Gaza Strip, as you mentioned, and then Lebanon, and perhaps, again, aspirations of Israel. Do you think that Israel is going to go through with this? And the problem here is that the U.S. is backing it. One way or another, we've seen that that is an unshakable bond, as the U.S. has said time and again.
I'm not so sure it's an unshakable bond at this point, and ironically, I never would have predicted it, but I see more independence of action and mind and policy on the part of Trump vis-a-vis Israel than we've ever seen under Biden or preceding American administrations.
Well, let me jump in and ask you, what do you see as proof of that? Because Trump just 2 weeks ago released all the backup orders which included the 2,000-pound bombs to this Israel.
I agree. This man is very erratic. I don't think anybody is fully able to explain it. But I think there have been many indications that, first of all, that Israel Netanyahu is quite uncomfortable with what essentially is an American takeover of many aspects of Israeli policies. For example, as I think you're aware, Trump said that to solve the Gaza situation, that the U.S. would take over Gaza. He said this in Netanyahu's presence, who obviously looked extremely startled. I mean, Israel wants Gaza, not the U.S. to dominate Gaza. So that's the start. There have been other signs of tensions. He has been sending, I'm surprised, he named several Jewish negotiators, American Jewish negotiators, to go to the Middle East. But many of them have been quite tough with Netanyahu, including forcing him in very blunt and crude language to sign the ceasefire quite immediately. I think you know about this.
Yes.
When Witkoff went there, the ceasefire was about to come to an end. It needed to be re-signed, and Witkoff was assigned to go to get this done within the few days before it ran out. He said, I am coming to Israel on Saturday, and we are going to sign this document. And the Israelis said, oh, I'm sorry, Saturday is Shabbat, our holy day, so we can't do business on Shabbat. And Witkoff, who is an American Jew, is said to have said, I don't give a shit about your Shabbat. I'm coming, and you're signing the document. This Bibi is not used to this kind of language. So, and then coupled with the remark just the other day, as I quoted earlier, that somebody, I think it was Witkoff, said Israel, that the U.S. is not Israel's pawn, or whatever the word was, puppet or pawn. So I think there is greater tension growing between Bibi on the one hand and Trump on the other. But if you ask me about those bombs, what can I say? The best explanations, my personal explanation, is that he's showing we will support you, and here's a sign that we're supporting you, but by God, we are going to be more in control of what these policies are. Maybe this is my final farewell gift. I don't know, Kaveh. I don't know. But I'm trying to best interpret this as best I can. And that Trump wants to seize control back from Bibi, which America has never had up to now. He will never succeed in doing that entirely. Sure. But I see the signs of this.
Sure. Well, one of the signs was when Trump on social Truth platform that he owns posted an interview that Jeffrey Sachs had, political analyst, and we know the views that he expressed in that particular post against Netanyahu. The thing here is that we're looking at the way that, sounds of war is being echoed through the chambers, whether it's in the White House, whether it's in the Israeli regime's compounds, and maybe other places. For example, what do you make of the deal that the U.S. has now sealed with Saudi Arabia, apparently, which is to the tune of $1 trillion. That involves military sales. Saudi Arabia purchasing military sales, not $1 trillion, but a portion of it. Well, it's got to use it at some point. So what could Trump have said in order for Saudi Arabia to want to purchase that? We know in the past it's been the Iranophobia factor.
Yes, but I think, Kaveh, you surely are aware of one of the most dramatic diplomatic events in the Middle East over the last 2 years was when China intervened to negotiate and mediate between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think almost all Middle Eastern specialists were startled by that event. Some more ignorant commentators on the Middle East would have said, oh, well, Shiites hate Sunnis, and this is until the end of time. It's a permanent state of affairs. Well, when China came, it was able to negotiate and mediate an agreement that I think is extraordinarily important, and it suggests that Saudi Arabia is no longer finding its major role in the Middle East. I think the Gulf states in general are no longer finding that they want to sign up with the American anti-Iranian agenda. That's not going to work. It's not helping the region. It's pushing it towards war. But yeah, I'm sure Trump is happy to maybe sell some weapons to Saudi Arabia. He's very much hoping at some point that he can bring some deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia, a peace treaty. I don't know what Trump thinks about all of this. It's wide open. But that's the best explanation that I can give to it. I truly believe that Saudi Arabia is serious about putting an end to this conflict with Iran. It's pointless, it has very little ground, and it's been mainly engineered and supported by Washington over the years in the search for regional enemies.
All right, very well. Thank you so much. Let me thank you, Graham Fuller, American author and political analyst. Thank you so much for joining us in this edition of Unscripted.
My pleasure, Kaveh. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, that was Graham Fuller. As I mentioned, American author and political analyst. We had the pleasure of having him, and we talked at length, no surprise, about West Asia. Until the next Unscripted, for me, Kaveh Tatlı, is goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is related to the month that we are currently in. As you know, we are in the month of Ramadan. Of course, we are towards the end of Ramadan. And as you know, the month of Ramadan is a very significant month. It's important for a number of reasons. One of the reasons it's so significant is that this month is the month in which fasting has been made obligatory upon us. We're obliged to fast in this month, in contrast to the rest of the months of the year. So in this connection, we want to ask, what are the etiquettes of fasting? You know, as you know, every act of worship has certain adab or certain etiquettes that, you know, may not be obligatory. They may be obligatory. Some of them are obligatory. Some of them are not obligatory. Some of them are simply recommended. But nevertheless, they improve the quality of the deed, and they also increase the chances of its acceptance by God Almighty. Right, so in order to answer this very important question, we'll look at some hadiths which have been transmitted from, you know, our infallibles, alayhim assalam, regarding this subject. By way of example, in one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, said, Allah, mighty and exalted, says, he whose limbs do not fast by refraining from what I have prohibited, then there is no need for him to refrain from food and drink for my sake. This hadith, of course, is significant. It's a hadith al-Qudsi, or a sacred hadith, as you know. A hadith al-Qudsi is a hadith which the Prophet or one of the infallibles narrates from God Almighty. So they're actually the words of God passed down to the Prophet or the Imams. The only difference is that with these hadith al-Qudsi and the Quran is that, you know, these are not part of the Quran, and, you know, the rules and ahkam related to the Quran are not applicable to it. So in this beautiful hadith, God Almighty says that just like when you fast, your stomach, you keep your stomach away from drinking and eating, and you keep, you know, your other limbs and organs away from the things which have been prohibited from them and which might invalidate the fast. You should also keep your other limbs away from sins, you know, sins that might not invalidate the fast per se, but are nevertheless, you know, sins and have, are wrong and should not be committed. For example, you shouldn't lie. Of course, lying, you know, certain lies might invalidate your fast. Like if you lie against God, or tell a lie about the Prophet or the Quran or these kind of things. But a normal lie, you know, a lie in another context, it might not invalidate the fast, but it's a sin. So you should keep away from these sins as well in the month of Ramadan. This improves the quality of your fasting, increases the chances of it getting accepted by God Almighty. In a similar tradition, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, fasting is just as much keeping away from prohibited things as it is keeping away from food and drink. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at some of the etiquettes of fasting in the light of the ahadith of the infallibles. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A reminder of our top stories. More than 3,000 vessels of the Iranian Navy and Basij volunteer forces have held a massive parade in support of the people of Palestine. Over 24 Palestinians have been killed in the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza as a death toll since renewed attacks on March the 18th, which is 855. And U.S. President Donald Trump announces 25% tariffs on auto imports, with Washington's trading partners slamming the move, warning that the measure threatens global economic stability. Hello from the Iranian capital, Tehran. I am Bahman Nourai, and this is news. More than